Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Dr. Paul Clayton är farmakolog och forskare inom nutrition. Han kan helt enkelt väldigt mycket om det här med matens påverkan på kroppen. Och han ska nu ha ett samtal tillsammans med Lina om matberoende. Finns det någonting som heter det egentligen och hur definierar man det i så fall? Ja, det börjar i alla fall där, det här samtalet, och sen glider in på en massa andra spännande saker. Så luta dig tillbaks och njut av denna otroligt spännande intervju med Dr. Paul Clayton.
Hi and welcome Paul Clayton.
Hello there from Florida. Hello Lena. Hello Food Pharmacy.
We're so grateful to have you in our podcast once again. Today I was thinking about asking you some questions in regards to food addiction. But before we start, I would like to for you to tell us, where did your interest in food and health start?
I mean, this goes back at least 6.5 decades. I've always been interested in food and cooking. And as time passed, now I'm moving up towards 1968 and I went to medical school. I was taking all kinds of classes then, not just in the medical school, but also in the veterinary course as well. And they were talking a great deal about nutrition. And it just seemed to me illogical that this should not also be a significant component in medical training. But that was all about physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, bacteriology, you know, all the rest of those sub-disciplines. And then at the end of all of that, the answer was always going to be a pharmaceutical product, inevitably, because a large part of the structures of medicine, whether you're talking about training or practice, have largely been captured, increasingly so, by the pharmaceutical industry, which has a concentration of wealth and political leverage that has increasingly constrained the medical professions. Professionals' ability to help their patients in any ways that are not contained within largely pharmaceutically defined diagnostic and treatment algorithms. So my interest in food has a long history, and it's become more pronounced the more I've learned about the limitations of pharmaceutical orthodox medicine.
When you talk about food and health, it's hard not to talk about the obesity pandemic that we are encountering. And that has led to a pandemic in other lifestyle-related diseases. So why is that? Why is the world suffering from an obesity pandemic?
Well, there's more than one answer. And you could start off by saying, quite reasonably, that our food environment has changed in a way which encourages obesity. That is, we're consuming more foods now which are ultra-processed and very energy dense and non-satiating and addictive, and we'll come to that. And at the same time, for many of us, our lifestyles have become significantly less physical. And so our levels of physical activity and then calorific throughput have declined by as much as 50%, perhaps even more, since, let's say, the second half of the 19th century. So on the one hand, we're consuming these very energy-dense foods, which don't really satisfy hunger cravings. On the other hand, we're utilizing less calories than before in physical activities. And here we are, we're at the the junction of these two very negative forces. And from this perspective, the continuously increasing problems of overweight and obesity make they seem pretty obvious. The reason why I think we have been so unable to get to grips with them is that we're not addressing the root causes of this problem. Drugs are certainly not the answer, whether you're talking about amphetamine derivatives or whether you're talking about Wegovy, which is the most recent drug of choice. These are not the answers. The problems are deeply embedded in our society, and they require really more radical approaches than the pharmaceutical industry can offer us.
Mm. Would you consider food addiction a real thing?
Well, this is a debate that has been going on in addiction and generally psychological circles for probably a couple of decades now. And I've been following a lot of this. Now, first of all, let me just say, I'm not an expert in addiction, nor am I really an expert in food addiction, but it is an area that greatly interests me. And so I do write about it, and I do try to keep up with some of the research. And I would say that until recently, the case was looking stronger, that food addiction was a real thing. Still wasn't completely proven, but there was a very interesting paper came out in the journal Addiction in November of last year, written by Ashley Gearhart and Alexandra De Felice Antonio. And they're a couple of scientists who are based in Virginia and Michigan here in the United States. And I think that they've done a great deal to finally crystallize this debate out. And they looked at it like this. What are the primary criteria, the scientific criteria that denote addiction? Does this apply to ultra-processed foods, which occupy an increasingly large share of our shopping basket and our dinner tables these days? They're typically foods full of refined carbohydrates and added fats. Do the primary scientific criteria that we use when we think about addiction, do they actually apply to these foods? So what are those criteria? Well, one of them would be, does this product or do these products cause highly controlled or compulsive and repetitive use? Do they cause mood-altering effects via an effect that is perhaps measurable in terms of some aspect of brain activity? Do they create reinforcing behavior? And then finally, do they trigger strong urges or cravings? So those are the four criteria which were used, for example, to designate tobacco, finally, as being addictive. Do they apply to foods? Well, they then ask the question, is there a phenotype, that is a kind of person and a kind of personal behavior that reflects all of these hallmarks? They did an enormous amount of research and looked at all of the meta-analyses that have been done in this area. And they reckon, well, based on these criteria, about one in seven adults, about one in eight children have this type of behavioral patterns. And so they think, yes, a significant number of people do genuinely have food addiction. So their conclusion is, yes, ultra-processed foods do meet these criteria, and they do affect a significant number of people. Now, what does that mean? Does it even matter if some people are addicted to food? Well, I think that has to be a yes as well. If you accept that these ultra-processed foods meet the criteria of being addictive substances, well, then we have to do something about it, because the evidence that they are really damaging our health, both individually and at the public health level, is overwhelming. So firstly, these products are very light in nutrients. They have a very low nutrient density. They've got a lot of empty calories. They're very calorie dense. And there's been study after study after study that show that the more of these ultra-processed foods you eat, the more you become overweight in the short term, medium term, and the long term. From my perspective, and I'm looking at this very much from a pharmacological perspective, I can then add to that by saying, well, it's clear when I look at the composition of these foods, they cause chronic inflammatory stress, which we know is a bad thing. We know that they cause type B malnutrition because they're so depleted in so many micro and phytonutrients. We know that they cause dysbiosis because their formulation is so terrible. They're almost devoid of prebiotic fiber. We know that they cause glycemic mismatch or overload because they contain far too much sugar and far too much simple carbohydrates. So these, I understand now, as being the four major drivers of our appalling public health profile, and it's worsening. And when you add into the fact that these psychologists are now saying, and I think convincingly, that these ultra-processed foods are addictive, and more of us are consuming more and more of them, well, it's good business for the food industry. They're very interested in making their food foods addictive. When we buy more of them, their profits go up. It is absolutely terrible for us. I would make the case that these addictive ultra-processed foods are more responsible than any other single factor for our declining public health. And they are a key factor in driving up public health care costs, which are today spiraling completely out of control.
So what responsibility could you put on the food industry? I mean, in a market economy?
I think if you're asking me to try to deconstruct the market economy, we're now... Look, I mean, that's an interesting question. And if we had a couple of hours to sit down over a glass of good wine, we could have a discussion about that. But then we get into very complicated and very diffuse areas of where does personal responsibility stop? What responsibility does the state have? And I really am not in favor of giving the state very much responsibility at all, because state power is like cancer. It inevitably grows and metastasizes. I want more people to take more responsibility for themselves, for their own behavior, and for their own health. I'm all for autonomy. The problem is that we are outgunned, heavily outgunned, by a multinational food industry that is grotesquely irresponsible, that is concerned only with its profit margins, and it's all about the privatization of profit, but the shedding of responsibility onto the shoulders of us, the poor, misinformed, uninformed, diseased, and dying consumers. So it's an unfair situation. It's an unequal situation. And I think that it's going to be very important at some stage to bring legal pressure to bear on the food industries in the same way that it was brought to bear on the tobacco industries to restrict sales of their toxic, addictive products. The same criteria apply to the food industries today and require similar solutions, in my view.
As a Swede, I'm sure you know that in Sweden, the politicians have had a strong influence over how we organize people's life. I mean, it has changed enormously during the last 20 years, but still we're very used to tax as instrument for changing behavior and things like that. And I always wonder that someone has to pay the price for this burden. And apart from the individual that has to pay the price, there is an enormous cost for the societies. Like, we have this welfare state still where the tax fundament is paying for the healthcare. And if Sweden was a company, I'm sure that the controller would say long time ago, hello, hello, this company will go bankrupt because we will not afford to take care of all the sick people if we don't go to the root cause of the problem.
It's really interesting that you should say that, because, of course, for much of my generation, the Swedish model, the Swedish concept of state responsibility, Swedish welfareism, has been the envy of the world. It's now being really terribly abused. It's been used against it. And I think that the Swedish politicians show the same kind of self-destructive behavior that we're seeing in political circles in many other countries, particularly in the West. I'm not sure it makes sense any longer to talk in terms of, you know, left and right. What you have in most countries is a uniparty. These people have far more in common with each other on both sides of the political spectrum than they do with people who are outside the political system. They talk to each other. They have entirely incestuous relationships, and very few of them take their responsibility to the electorate at all seriously. They're mostly in the business of self-aggrandizement and self-enrichment. That's particularly obviously true here in North America, but it is becoming very prevalent in many Western states. Having said that, I find it very intriguing that you were apparently advocating a move away from a political kind of system towards a corporate system. That perhaps we should run this more along the lines of the business. I'm not convinced that's exactly the right way to go either. And if you look at the irresponsibility of the food industry, which, as I said, socializes its costs but privatizes its profits, that's not exactly a good example for corporatism as being benign. In this case, it most certainly isn't. Having said that, corporations will eventually rise, succeed or fail on the basis of their business strategies. And so there is a winnowing process, which doesn't take care of situation in politics. In politics, politicians who fail are usually promoted. And that's what you see certainly at the level of the EU. So I'm not absolutely sure that untrammeled, unrestrained corporatism is in fact the way forwards. The broader problem perhaps is that political systems and corporate systems are becoming so entangled, so intermarried, that it's actually beginning to be rather difficult to separate them. Mm. And this is, excuse me for using the term, this is what was originally defined as fascism. That is what Mussolini termed fascism, the merger of state and business, or as he put it, guilds. That's certainly what you see very increasingly in the West, where more and more politicians are very clearly in the pocket of lobbying groups which represent industrial sectors. So the politics that I grew up with no longer exists. You no longer have parties that represent, for example, you know, the workers. That's a charmingly old-fashioned term. Mm. They mostly represent themselves. The largest proportion of them are crooks, and the ones that aren't are incredibly stupid. And here we are in 2023, marching inexorably towards what looks like World War III, because there are not enough politicians with sufficient independence of thought to be able to say, no, we cannot continue down this road. We must sit down. We must negotiate. Mm. It's all very alarming. And in this context, problems like food addiction suddenly don't seem to be quite so serious.
No, that's the problem. And also the problem is that there is a big need. If you go to social media, I think that many influencers, at least in Sweden, are talking about that we have become so health-oriented, so we become unhealthy. And I, of course, disagree with that, because if the problem would be that we would suffer from unhealthiness due to that we try to be healthy in everything we do, we wouldn't have this obesity pandemic and lifestyle-related diseases. But we as ordinary people are fed with the view that it's unhealthy to become too healthy, if you understand what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think very few people really fit into that category. Just one glance at public health figures should be enough to convince you that the larger majority, the vast majority of the country, whether it's Sweden or the United States, are incredibly unhealthy. So, for example, we have a situation now where about 2/3 of all deaths are due either to cardiovascular and cerebrovascular pathologies or to cancers. That already is telling you something very, very seriously wrong. Look at vestigial cultures. And these diseases, you still find them, but at levels that are probably, you know, 10% of the levels that we see now. So that's saying right away, this is a very, very unhealthy culture we're creating. But those are just two broad areas of pathology. If you look at the neurodegenerative diseases, the autoimmune diseases, the metabolic diseases, all of them continue to get worse almost from year to year, which is overall the reason why life expectancy is now starting to fall back in many areas of the so-called developed world. So this is, I mean, are there are there a few individuals who are so obsessed with health that they're following extreme diets and becoming unhealthier in the process? Undoubtedly. But this is a disproportionately small minority of the overall population.
Mm. We talked about malnutrition before. So this is the first time in history where we actually see obese people that suffer from important deficiencies. So what would you consider as the most dangerous forms of deficiencies today?
Well, there have been a number of studies that show that some of the people with the highest BMIs actually have the worst nutritional profiles. And the reason for that is that to really get up the scale towards being overweight and then overweight and then the various degrees of obesity and moving towards progressively more morbid extremes of obesity, you can only get there by eating these ultra-processed foods. And so you're getting a lot of empty calories, getting larger, but your nutritional status is absolutely terrible because you're getting there on largely empty calories. So being overweight and being nourished, it may seem like a paradoxical combination, but actually it's quite logical when you look at how these people get to those physiological endpoints.
Mm. Talking about supplements, many people today might have a very poor diet and try to have supplements as a sort of shortcut.
Mm.
What would you say about that?
It seems logical if you accept the case that a large part of our ill health is related to the diet and you think, well, there's got to be something wrong with it, something missing. Let me make up for that. And so people take a fish oil product or a multivitamin. These are the two largest sectors, individual sectors in the overall supplement market. And they're worth billions. But when you look at the science, and these things have been repeatedly tested in very large studies over long periods of time, what has been shown is, this is absolutely irrefutable now, fish oil supplements do not work. They do not protect you from cardiovascular endpoints, from neurological endpoints, from retinal endpoints. I mean, they don't have any effect at all. And the same is true of vitamin and mineral supplements. They don't work. They absolutely don't work. And so the first order way of thinking about this, there's something missing, let's put something back in, it really doesn't work. You have to be more granular. You have to be more precise. And that's what I've been trying to do. That's what I've been looking at really for the last 20 years. And I think we are now at a point where we can move on from simply talking in terms of diseases of civilization. And you may have heard me talk about this.
Mm.
To call these degenerative diseases, diseases of civilization, doesn't really help us. It doesn't tell us anything. It doesn't say anything about how these diseases are being driven. And that, in turn, does not allow us to begin to start to think about antidotes. So I've been trying to parse the many, many hundreds of variables that are contained in the modern diet and lifestyle to see what it might be that actually is making us more ill. And I think we're at a point now where we can identify four main drivers and a couple of minor ones, which between them are making us much more vulnerable, which are reducing our ability to buffer ourselves from the problems and the stresses that you incur just by being alive. So the margins of safety that have been built into us by the evolutionary process at the cellular level and at the tissue level and at the organism level, they're all being overloaded and they're being overrun. So let's look at what these four drivers are. And I'll talk about one of the minor ones as well. And they appear to be chronic inflammatory stress, as I was implying earlier, dysbiosis, type B malnutrition, and glycemic mismatch. And then issues which are related to electrolyte imbalances are probably coming in at number five. And there's one or two other rather more minor things that are, that seem to be involved in this overall package as well. Now, what Zinzino allowed me to do was to take this research that I'd been doing and develop it into a small portfolio of what I think of as antidotes. So we have ways of damping chronic inflammation, of reversing dysbiosis, of restoring a reasonably healthy micro and phytonutrient profile. And now we have ways of neutralizing the impact of an excessively glycemic load in your food. And what we're seeing when we do this in the people who follow this regime, I think what we're doing is we're putting your metabolome in a time machine and we're sending it back 150 years to a time before ultra-processed foods existed, to a time when people's health expectancy was better than it is today. In practical terms, what that means is that individuals who invest in this approach, who decide to follow this program, in the majority of cases, they become pharmaceutically independent. So if they had a condition that was requiring chronic medication, within a relative short period of time, typically 6 to 8 months, they find they no longer need it. That is, I think, the way forward. And it's not foods. The food continues, you know, the food environment continues to be awful. These are not supplements in the classic sense at all. They're pharmaconutritional antidotes to the drivers of chronic degenerative disease today. It's a third way, if you like. And it seems, on the basis of the feedback that we're getting, to be extremely effective. And perhaps even more importantly, to me anyway, it's logical.
Mm.
And it's testable. Mm.
Would you say it's still advisable to, I mean, have an overall good diet, or is it less important?
You know, the bad news is that if you're really lazy and you love junk foods, it's probably going to be sort of okay to keep on indulging all of your vices, providing you use this program. I didn't really want to admit that. What I would rather say to everybody is, honestly, it is better if you stop eating these ultra-processed foods, which in their current generation are so bad for you, and learn how to cook with basic produce. And I would urge people to do that anyway, because those types of foods taste so much better. And you learn how to cook and to work with seasonal produce, and it anchors you to the real world and to nature in a way that buying these individualized, ultra-processed, and detached products do not. They make us dependent. They make us sick. They distort and destroy our natural appetites. And they sever the connections that you would otherwise develop if you were going to the market, buying whatever produce is locally in season, and learning how to cook, learning how to use that. So I'm all in favor of taking a very old-fashioned approach to your eating. And if you have access to, let's say, a little garden where you could grow some of your own food, again, do that, not just for your health, but because in a way that is equally profound, it brings you back into touch with the real world, as opposed to the world that you enter through the screen of your mobile phone, which is not quite as real.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So if you sit and listen to this and you suffer from overweight, obesity, and maybe malnutrition, where would you recommend to start? Because it's so overwhelming. I mean, we know that you can't exercise your way out from a bad diet. No. And what are the advice you would tell someone that has lost hope in a way and can't see clearly where to start?
I think that if you're really in a bad situation where you're very overweight, you're very regularly consuming these ultra-processed foods, I think we come back to where we started. Consider this issue of addiction. Now, there are various anti-addiction programs, some of which are very like the programs that were designed and work, you know, with some efficacy to help people to come off their addiction to, let's say, alcohol or to other drugs.
Like 12-step program we're talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly. Mm. This has actually been used with some success by some therapists and other people. And this is really interesting because, again, it goes to the idea of these foods being addictive. Some people have actually tried treating food addiction with naltrexone, which is, you know, it's the anti-opiate.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Some people are doing that, and they've also had some success. And be aware. I mean, the problem is the food industry uses bliss point technology, which was developed by Howard Moskowitz back in the 80s or 90s. And it's been refined to such a point that they are able to make these foods, which in terms of mouthfeel and flavor, have this wonderful impact. I mean, you know, everybody loves chocolate and ice cream, those types of foods. But the problem is, these types of foods, which by delivering a lot of sugar, a lot of fats, they raise what we call the TIG index. And the TIG index is really bad news. It's probably the best marker we have for determining how likely you are to go on to develop, for example, cardiovascular disease. We also know from other scientists' work that this type of diet really damages the hippocampus. And the nucleus accumbens in the hypothalamus. And they lead eventually over time to damage to these structures, which means that your appetites become distorted. You forget what it felt like to enjoy good food. So the hippocampus, again, a little bit esoteric, but it's interesting to me and to anyone else who's interested in neurophysiology. Some really good work was done on this, which showed that even after a short period of eating these rather dangerous and addictive foods, test subjects develop cravings for more of the same, even when they're not hungry. They also show impaired cognition. Their ability to think actually becomes degraded. And this creates a perfect marketing loop. You eat the junk, you like it, you crave more junk, you forget just how bad that junk food made you feel, and then you eat more of it. And yeah, as I said, if you eat enough of this for long periods of time, the normal relationship between the parameters of hunger and the appetite for ultra-processed foods is completely broken. So that people will then start reaching for biscuits and candy bars, even when they're not hungry. Mm. And the more you go down that road, the more degeneration and destruction you see in the hippocampus. And that is directly related to distortion of appetite, neuroinflammation, impaired mental health, impaired intelligence. And we've got some really good data to show that now, and a hugely increased risk of neurodegenerative disease. Mm. So my advice would be, try getting off your addiction to these ultra-processed foods. And that means probably 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, with none of these types of foods. And what many therapists are finding is that after this kind of period, if you can go cold turkey for perhaps 2 weeks, at the end of that, a lot of these cravings disappear. And you can then start to re-educate your palate and start learning to enjoy the multiple wonders and delights of a wider palette of basic truths.
Mm. So a lot of things starts with awareness. And when I tried fasting the first time in my life, I actually got aware of how much I eat in a day, mm-hmm. And how much I put in my mouth based on that I want to feed my emotions. And I'm not hungry. I just walk around and I feel stressed or restless or tired something. And the lack of food, you talked about stop eating these foods for 2 weeks. I would also say that from my own experience, fasting made me realize that it's not dangerous to go without food. It's not dangerous to feel a craving or what you think is hunger, because
absolutely.
So what do you think about fasting? That made me curious to ask you, because I started to think about it when you mentioned this.
Well, the interesting thing is that people who are really trapped in that junk food, overeating, comfort eating cycle, they don't know how to deal with hunger. In many cases, they mistake thirst for hunger. They will mistake emotional stress for hunger. For many people, these cues are being somehow misdirected. And I think a lot of this is due to the hypothalamic and hippocampal damage that we know these terrible foods create. It's made worse, I think, by the fact that many parents will use comfort foods to reward children, to stop them from behaving badly or to encourage good behavior. And that sets up really unfortunate connections at a very early stage in life. And you then, in the longer term, are going to associate food and typically children's types of foods, and they're very often they're sweet and full of sugars and fats. You will associate that with some kind of reward. That's a really bad link to set up during a child's formative years. And it's made worse by the fact that children's foods these days are more poorly configured than ever. They are absolutely full of sugars, particularly sugars and salts. And if you wanted to create a generation of young addicts, and I imagine the food industry does want to do this, that's exactly how you would go about it.
Mm.
But the idea of stepping off this escalator and understanding what hunger is, and understanding that being hungry is not going to harm you, and you can survive it, and that eventually the feelings of hunger pass, and you move into a kind of a flow state where you actually get more energy, and you feel better. And when the time finally does come to eat, you enjoy it more. I mean, you can move from a vicious circle to a virtuous circle, but you have to step off that conveyor belt to begin with. That might be a little bit difficult to begin with, but hunger is not something to be feared, not at all. Actually, it's to be welcomed.
Yeah, because the food never tastes as good as when you experience true hunger.
That's absolutely true.
Yes. So we talked about drugs in the beginning of this episode. We talked about drugs against obesity. And I understand you're not in favor of these drugs, but I mean, isn't the problem that if you get on a drug against your obesity, you will have to eat that for all your life, because when you stop, you will probably go back to getting obese again? Or?
I think so, because the drugs largely treat symptoms. And that's a criticism you could make of most of the weapons in the pharmaceutical armory. They largely treat symptoms. And this is what we've seen with, for example, Wegovy, which is one of the most recent of the anti-obesity drugs it's made the headlines and it's become very popular in some quarters. And we already know, we've seen this happening, that once people stop the course, they put the calories back on. Well, if you go back to your old habits, your old lifestyle, which is in many cases characterized by low levels of physical activity and an excessive amounts of ultra-processed foods with all their empty calories, then of course you're going to go back to where you were. So I'm not sure that there are any pharmaceutical shortcuts. The drug industry would love to have you believe that, of course, but I don't believe it. I think that you have to reconsider some of the basic aspects of the way in which you live and reconfigure them. Mm-hmm. And at that point, when you do that, then you start going on a different track. We know from vestigial cultures that the idea that you have to get heavier as you get older, that you have to accumulate more adipose tissue, that you have to experience rising blood pressure or rising cholesterol, or you become more diabetic. A lot of these things, which we think of as an inevitable part of getting older, they don't occur in vestigial cultures. They're nothing to do with getting older. They are to do with getting older in a profoundly unhealthy food environment and culture.
Mm. Would you say, talking about diet, is there a one-size-fits-all? Is there something that's common for all of us human when it comes to diet, apart from not having ultra-processed food? What should we eat? What is good for everyone?
Well, I think that one of the... I don't want to be too prescriptive. I mean, some people feel more comfortable on certain types of diets than others, but I don't believe in the blood-type diet. I think that if you want to experiment with vegetarianism or veganism, if you want to go keto or all the rest of those things, they all seem to have their adherence. There is some evidence that a low carbohydrate diet is probably a better way to go for most people. I think that there is evidence that a piscivorian diet may be one of the better diets, but I think you should always keep in mind the fact that the metabolism doesn't run on binary logic. It's a fuzzy system. There are all kinds of loops and feedbacks. And the reason, one of the reasons for the evolutionary success of our species, apart from our intelligence, which is up for debate, is the fact that we are capable of utilizing so many different types of fuel. We can run on many, many different types of diets for many decades, certainly long enough to be able to procreate. And that is a strength. So I'm not going to be very stringent about this. I'm not going to be very prescriptive and you say, you know, you've got to eat this diet or that diet. I think there are certain basic elements that you need to cover. And, you know, you need to have enough of the right selection of amino acids. You need to have a healthy 6-to-3 balance. You need a certain amount of prebiotic fibers. Then you have to cover your micro and phytonutrient requirements as well. If you do all of that already, you're going to be well set up. After that comes the fine tuning. That's where food preferences come in. That's where local food availability comes in. That's where cultural preferences come in as well. But the fact is, it's perfectly possible to be a healthy centenarian vegetarian Hindu, for example. And it's also perfectly possible to be a healthy centenarian omnivore in Loma Linda or Okinawa.
Mm.
So our pluralism, the fuzziness of our metabolism is actually, it's a strength. Mm. And I think that so many people will say, oh, I'm vegetarian because vegetarians are healthier and they live longer. And that's not the case. There's no evidence that they live longer. I mean, they die slightly differently. There's some evidence that they're slightly more miserable. But were they more miserable when they started or as a result of their diet? That's not entirely clear. So in the end, you make your personal choices. That's fine. But get the basics right.
Mm. How do you eat yourself?
Indiscriminately.
Yeah.
Well, I cook everything. I tend not to eat very much ultra-processed food, actually very little. I love to cook, and I love to work with basic produce. And over the course of a pretty long lifespan, I've traveled to all of the different continents, and everywhere where I've gone, I've been very keen on learning to cook how, you know, people do locally. So I cook Italian and Thai and Indian and some African dishes, and you know, like that. I just like food.
Mm. So, but do you yourself have the pharmaconutrients that we talked about?
I do. I take them myself. And I think that one of the reasons, I look around, I'm in Florida, which is full of geriatrics. And I see people of my own age who look a generation older than I do. And I think that what I see around me is that you can age at different rates. Chronologically, it's all the same, but biological aging clearly can be accelerated and slowed down. And from what I see and from what I know of other people who use this protocol, you can slow biological aging. From what I see when I look around here, most people are accelerating theirs for no good reason that I can think of, other than the fact that they have been colonized by a criminally irresponsible food industry and are let down, by the way, by an equally immoral pharmaceutical industry and a supplement industry that doesn't know what it's doing.
So to the answer, if there is a one size fit all, you actually say that you think that more or less everyone would benefit from this health protocol that you have been a part of developing.
Yes, or by switching to a diet which contains the same ingredients. And clearly we didn't evolve as a species taking supplements or pharmaconutritional protocols. None of that was necessary. But if you go back to the second half of the 19th century, and these are the mid-Victorians that I spent so much time researching, you had a population there that was, in general, if you look at what they were eating, their diet contained the health protocol, the key elements of the health protocol. So they didn't need to take supplements. They didn't need to use a health protocol. But if you look at their health expectancy, as I said, it was much, much better than ours is today. They simply were not as vulnerable to chronic degenerative diseases and growing disability as we are. So it is perfectly possible to achieve these benefits if you know how to eat. And also, and this is key, we're now talking about a society that existed before the internal combustion engine, before information technology. They were consuming a lot of food, basic produce, and a lot of it, about twice as much as we could consume now. So in order to get there, you need to imagine quite a fundamental restructuring of the way in which our culture operates. Well, we did touch on programs that had been developed to help people with food addiction. And there is a group called Overeaters Anonymous, which maybe, I don't know if it exists in Scandinavia, but certainly it's here in the United States. And they use this something that's very like the 12-step program that was originally developed for Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's really difficult dealing with food addiction because you can stop drinking alcohol because you don't actually need it unless you're psychologically pretty damaged. But you can't stop eating.
No.
You can take people out of an environment where there is heroin or fentanyl or tobacco. You cannot remove people from an environment which contains food because we are required to eat in order to live. So I think that these types of food addiction programs are really useful, and they will work better if they're combined with an educational component which explains to people the damaging, the very destructive nature of ultra-processed foods and cooking classes. People need to be reassured that learning how to cook with basic produce is actually really easy. It used to be that it was a fairly commonplace for schools to have a class on what was called domestic science in the core curriculum. And domestic science, which mostly girls used to take rather than boys, was all about how to cook, basically, how to work with basic produce. And it was removed to make way for really important things like CRT and how terrible it is to be white and all that kind of stuff. But unfortunately, we forgot. We threw out something very valuable, because by not teaching young children how to be gastronomically independent, how to cook their own food, we made them dependent on takeaways and on ultra-processed foods being sold by the multinationals. And looking back, I can't help but think that a lot of the moves to have domestic science removed from the core curriculum was actually sponsored by the food multinational companies. So we can't get away from politics. Started off with addiction, we talk about food and nutrition, we dip into politics again and again and again, and we cannot escape the fact that food preferences, food production, food consumption, these are all cultural activities and they're all politically embedded. And we have, unfortunately, a desperately unhealthy, a very destructive political system, as you do in Sweden now. It has done so much to damage the Swedish nation and Swedish culture. It has degraded so much in the last decade or so. And we're seeing something very similar over here.
So thank you, Paul Clayton. It's been an honor to have you at this show, and I'm already looking forward to have another interview with you.
I'm sure there'll be all kinds of people who dislike vehemently the political points that I'm making. I have merely advanced them as discussion points. People will have their different points of view, and you know, I'm always happy to debate.
Yeah, it's important. So thank you for taking time to come onto our show.
Thank you.
Du har lyssnat på Food Pharmacy-podden med Lina Nertby och Mia Klase. Denna vecka utan Mia, men istället med Dr. Paul Clayton. Jag heter Sebastian Ring och står för musik och redigering. Och vill du ha mer av oss på Food Pharmacy så finns vi på foodpharmacy.se och på Instagram under namnet food_pharmacy. Hej då!
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.